Podcast with a K. Hello, I'm Christian Corley. I'm joined by James McLean for this podcast with a K, in which we're discussing the return of Doctor Who. Which is the excitement in my voice. I don't know if that works for you or not. It feels more like a relief than anything else at the moment. I'm drying up a little bit. There's so much going on in my head with regards to Doctor Who at the moment. So we're going to talk about the pilot, which was previously known, apparently, I'm told, as The Girl with a Star in Her Eye, if you've seen the pilot, for obvious reasons. Now, this is the opening to Series 10. If you haven't seen this, you know, don't listen, because you're going to get spoiled. Unless you like being spoiled, which is fine, listen. Before we go into that, do you know, James, it is 12 years since Aliens of London, this weekend.
It's a long time, isn't it?
It is. Does it seem like 12 years to you?
No, I don't think it does, does it? I think once you get past, 24, that sort of time scale sort of shifts. No, 12 years it doesn't feel like. But yeah, it does feel like we've had quite a lot of shows since then, I suppose.
It's a strange thing, yeah. Because Aliens of London was really where, obviously you had Rose, and you had The End of the World, and then you had The Unquiet Dead. And Aliens of London was where people started frowning about Doctor Who's return because of the finger quote silly aliens in the Slitheen.
Yeah.
And there were some bad jokes in there as well. Plenty of fart jokes. Which takes us neatly into the pilot, because we've got a new setup of the Doctor, Bill, and we've got Pearl Mackie, and Nadol returning, Matt Lucas. And pretty much his first line of any particular note was essentially a bodily outburst joke, wasn't it? Which a few people have been, I didn't even notice it, to be honest with you. A few people have been talking about it who felt it was a bit unnecessary. Now there is some humour throughout. I do wonder though if Stephen Moffat, as a writer who's background is in comedy, and this is possibly my only criticism of the episode, which I would hang anything upon, is he should probably be doing better gags than that.
I didn't see the gag.
Well, there's a toilet joke in the TARDIS when Bill says she needs to use the toilet.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he
yes.
says, I'd leave it for a few minutes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's no, yeah. It didn't work for me.
Okay, that's fair enough.
And the whole point of the toilet there just seemed to be something which almost intuitively he knew that Radio Times would pick up and probably do an article on.
They do that about anything, though, don't they?
That's what I mean. It felt very, you know, weird, wacky, crazy, exciting things. We now know TARDIS has a toilet. It's like, oh, yeah. And I suppose he's got a kitchen as well. And, you know, who cares?
Well, Bill thought upon entering the TARDIS that it was like a kitchen. Well, let's rewind back through this episode, because we get a fresh new approach to Doctor Who. We get the Doctor having occupied a seat as a tutor at a university, a lecturer, whatever. It's been a long time since I dropped out. I've forgotten what the correct terms are. James may be able to fill me in here. And everything feels to me a lot more fresh, as if perhaps the past 3 or 4 years haven't happened.
Yeah, I think this is politically motivated. Well, I mean, sort of television politically motivated. I think there's been a surge in trying to sort of push forward, and it's going to be interesting to see whether the rest of the series falls back into old habits, or whether it does, or whether it carries on in this sort of vein of trying to sort of frame the past as relevant but not important, which is what the pilot sort of does all the way through. Mm. It's loads of those inner continuity reference, which Moffat seems to be absolutely obsessed with in the last few years, if you compare to Series 5, where there's none, virtually.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got Sonic Screwdrivers, you've got Susan, you've got River Song, You've got the out of order sign harking back to War Machines.
Yeah.
You've got
Vellans.
Vellans, absolutely. Obviously the Daleks as well.
Yeah, you've got a puddle monster, which could be related to the Lodger, which someone on Facebook has highlighted the similarities with the Lodger.
There's loads of things there which sort of hark back, but they don't dominate, and they certainly don't control the narrative. The Daleks' involvement in it is nice for fans, but it could have been anything. Could be any monster there. Avellans, again, is a nice moment for fans, but it's not focused on or extrapolated, which we suspected it would be. I mean, I talked about the prospect of the horrifying prospect of sort of like a prequel to Power of the Daleks, tying the Mavellan War into what leaves the Daleks stranded, you know, to be found in Power of the Daleks. But none of that was there, so that was really good. But it's whether it will carry on like that is going to be the question. Because, yeah, he seems to be wanting to sort of move on, or the BBC has asked, or he's feeling a need to show that he can move on before the new tenure of Chibnall comes in, which ultimately will move it on. So for whatever reason, you're right. I think it does feel like it's moving on. And as everyone has said, and as he's alluded to with the title, this is about sort of being a reboot. It's a Rose movement. And it works very well like that, doesn't it? It is refocusing. It's a character piece between the Doctor and the Companion. The monster isn't particularly mind-blowing in it, but then nor were the Autons in Rose. They're not there to be the central interest there, the sort of curiosity which surrounds the focus on these two characters. So yeah, I mean, my only issues with it, yeah, the toilet gag was a bit lame. I must admit, I'd forgotten about it. I think my issue, I thought, was at the beginning. I thought the first line where Pearl sort of introduces herself and her sexual orientation just felt utterly awkward. It felt hammered in. It didn't feel very real. It felt unnecessary. Even the Doctor sort of highlights as it's unnecessary, as if it's a writer's afterthought, as if he felt he needed to put that in there. But there's no flow to it, almost like it intentionally admits there's no flow to it. I was hoping this would go somewhere, she says. You know, it's as if this I want to put this in here, and then I'm going to put a note in there which kind of sort of highlights the fact that it doesn't connect to what her point was meant to be, and that becomes the point. That's probably the only thing which I thought was particularly poor in it.
Okay, there is, and you must all forgive me for this, dear listener. There is another side to this, and it's very bawdy, it's very lewd. And it could be completely my filthy, filthy mind, or it could be intentional, and someone must have noticed, but we're talking about a lesbian companion, and the girl that she fancies is dripping wet for most of the episode.
Yeah, I probably think that's you.
Right, okay. That's fine. That's fine if it is me.
I know where you're going.
Yeah, well, it's. So, let's overcome that then. I think maybe that's just... I mean, we got over that, didn't we? And things. I also think there's three types of exciting drama on TV, or three types of Doctor Who. One is the type where I completely forgot that time exists. Two is the type where I look at the clock to see how much time is left because I'm a little bit bored. And three is a time where I'm looking at the clock to see how much time is left because I'm trying to work out how they're going to get everything in before it ends. Last night it was the third.
Okay.
Which is, that's one of the pleasing, like that and forgetting number that one. Time exists. Yeah. They're the pleasing ones. I love the Capaldi as tutor moments doing the lectures.
Yeah.
They were good.
I thought he was nicely staged. I mean, I still, as I've said before, I still think his more occasionally aggressive mode was what would have given him his standout vibe. Mm-hmm. But this seems to be a happy mediation between sort of knocking that back and allowing him to sort of play a little more of a sort of relaxed, chilled out character. I don't know. There was just something nice about him. It wasn't like last season, where it would be a bit of this mixed with lots of crazy silliness. this sort of like fused the two. The crazy silliness, which was supposed to be like the lecture, isn't crazy silly. It is sort of like season 8 angry Capaldi focused into monologue. So it kind of works. It gives him authority. He has the authority of the season 8, while season 9 to me sort of devalued his authority, made him seem just a bit like a silly, doddery old man who was a bit cross occasionally, but most of the time was just trying to be like, I don't know, it just didn't work. If he carries on in this vein, I think it works. And it strikes me, it felt like Moffat's writing, he'd taken a step back a bit, and he wasn't trying to dominate it with whimsical jokes and clever ideas. He just sort of let it sort of sit back. I mean, the reflection thing wasn't a particularly amazing idea. I mean, I think most people watched it was probably thinking, probably because they know Doctor Who under his tenure, it's going to be the reflections the other way around. But still,
I couldn't work it out. I couldn't make it out, actually.
I couldn't make it out looking at the picture. I just kind of felt that would be the thing it will be, but I didn't know what that would represent.
Sure.
So in that sense, it doesn't matter if the audience got that. If the audience were one step ahead and realised it was the reflections the other way around, it doesn't matter because you still don't understand why the reflections the other way around yet. So that sort of, and that worked for me. It didn't try too hard. I think that was the real thing that got me with it. It didn't feel, it felt for the first time in a long time, it felt confident with who it was. The Doctor didn't need to be firing out 1,000 jokes per second. Capaldi looked really quite comfortable and relaxed. Pearl Mackey was very, very good.
Yes, she was.
Throughout it, as everyone has said, and that's really nice. Matt Lucas was good. I feel like he seemed slightly different to his character in the Christmas episode, who seemed to be a little more of a sort of Alfred in that, a little more judgmental on the Doctor, a little more of a sort of like an Alfred almost from Batman, sort of a fatherly figure almost, someone to sort of steer him a bit. And that didn't seem to be there as much this time. He seemed more of an Igor than an Alfred. But he still worked. As I say, apart from a couple of lines, just a little too overly comedy, but he was in the background, and it was nice to have that third person.
There's some speculation that he's a robot.
We did wonder. I couldn't remember what they said in the Christmas episode about him attaching the head. Did they attach it to the original body? Or
I never got my head around that either. But yeah, I mean, obviously there was that head thing going on when we first met him, wasn't there? So it's not beyond the realms of fiction that he could be either a robot or some sort of cybernetic cyborg thing.
Well, I assume we've got to assume he is a cyborg thing.
Yeah.
I'm assuming, unless there was a line. There was a line in the Christmas one, but because the Christmas one bored me so horrifically, my attention really wasn't there. It kind of felt like, I think we're going to assume that there is, as you say, the cyborg element. But then you've got the whole toilet joke, so I don't know. So yeah,
I'm going to pull us aside for one moment. I pulled our Facebook page for comments on the pilot. Yeah. There's a nice one here from Nigel Webb, who liked the comic relief from Matt Lucas, but perhaps just a little too much, less is more, etc. I like the resolution of the story, although he had to explain it to a friend down the pub. And then he finishes, Moffat had Capaldi poke his head round the corner with his guitar and sunglasses on in his first scene, surely to piss Christian, James and Brian off.
Well, I don't mind it. I kind of like, the guitar thing is fine with me. Because in the sense I said before, when he's got his hoodie on, he feels like an old man with youth to it, where Matt Smith felt like a young boy with age to him. Uh-huh. And that sort of made sense. But again, it's like with anything, it's how you use that. And in that opening episode, it was kind of cruddy.
I think the thing with the guitar is it's like, you know, Sherlock plays the violin, the Doctor plays the guitar. Makes sense. Well, not sure it does make sense.
It doesn't make sense. It is very Series 9. I suppose, yeah, now you've said that, that does irritate me. It is that sort of Series 9 inflection, as if Capaldi couldn't be allowed to be the sort of stern but energetic actor he is, that he had to sort of start carrying the whimsicalness of the generic Doctor template, where they've got to have wacky juxtapositions. You know, with Smith had to have the bow tie, you know, and so he's got to have the guitar. And the only thing I do like about the guitar is it has that sort of element, like with McCoy, where you're playing a little on some of the actor's own eccentricities. And adopting those into the role, because, you know, the Doctor to some degree should be a personification to some degree of the actor behind them. It should feel that they've got a bit of And that's where the difference in characters are staged. So, yeah, no, I didn't mind it. But, yeah, you're right. It doesn't really fit him, if I'm honest.
So, okay, so you're watching Doctor Who. Did you watch it live or did you watch it a little bit later?
I watched it live.
Okay, so you got to the end.
Yeah.
Probably about 8:05, whatever time it was. I watched it with a 5-minute delay due to domestic things, sorting the room out. Trying to work out why I couldn't see the telly clearly. That's because it's a light night. That old chestnut. How did you feel right at the end?
What bit are we talking about? The coming soon?
No, the end of the episode. How happy were you? How did you feel at the end of the episode?
The only thing that surprised me was for a pilot episode, we didn't see the TARDIS dematerialise or rematerialise. And I was just thinking, you know, in the sense if you're trying to sell this to new people, I thought that would have been something you'd do.
Right.
But I don't recall seeing it done at all.
No,
which is fine.
No,
and it sort of makes sense for the whole part of the episode, because the whole episode you are following M, pretty much scene by scene. It is following her in and out. You don't see any other characters beyond those three characters in their world. So there's no reason you would see that happen. But the last bit where they go in and the door closes, I kind of thought that would sort of introduce it to the new fans, that would be the bit of the pilot, which would just give you the full idea of what this was about. But I was okay with it. To a degree, I kind of didn't like the fact that he seemed to change his mind so easily after them sort of making such a big thing of him, to the point where he was going to wipe her brain.
Yeah.
That he was so stuck in this mindset, and then suddenly he's just switched. But then I suppose, you know, again, the Doctor is sometimes like that. You know, how many times have we seen him decide to take a direction on a coin toss,
yeah.
And then go in whatever direction he decides. So I suppose it's not
tonight, isn't it?
It's not that out of odds, I guess. And again, it echoes Rose, which I think was meant to some degree.
What do you think of the... this does echo Rose. Remember when the Doctor revealed that he'd bought Rose a bicycle?
No.
The Ninth Doctor... I can't remember. Was it... It may have been... it may have been the Empty Child.
Right.
It may not have been, though. It was one of Eccleston's happy moments, and she says, "Look at you, like your old Father Christmas." And he says, "Who says I'm not red bicycle when you were 12?
Oh yes,
yeah. And so his suggestion being at some point he's gone back in time and bought her a bicycle and left it outside the flat for her. And the Doctor seems to have done something similar for Bill. The box of photos that suddenly turns up of her mother.
Yes.
Which makes me wonder whether we're going to meet a mother at some point, because they've gone to the trouble of casting someone to take photos of them.
Yes.
That does,
I think that's likely.
Yeah, that does make you wonder. So that's what would
again,
you... Go on.
I was disappointed by that again, because I got the feeling from some of the press sort of junkety stuff was that it was going to be far more free-roaming, that, you know, that this was going to be about whisking a person off into time and space. And again, it feels that same... centering it into her background and her past and her family. The rooting of this university, I don't mind. I think that's kind of a fun idea. And the question of the vault is not too pushy, but, you know, obviously they've decided again they need the story thread. So you've got what's in the vault. Fine, okay, I'll deal with that. But, yeah, the mother and the step... Yeah, I don't know. It just, again, it feels like echoes the show doesn't need.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that 12 episodes is too short to be running sort of continuity slots. The show still needs to decide, is it episodic story anthology or is it serial? And this sort of mix between the two just doesn't suit Doctor Who for me. And I'm not saying that Doctor Who has to be a certain way. I'm just saying it could be either of those ways, but I think it needs to decide. You either serialize it, make it a serial story, a la Daredevil, if people need a point of reference, or you make it anthology, so each episode sort of carries its own story and it's just the characters that develop as it moves along. But this sort of mix just feels like just feels messy, and the sort of background, her background, just felt like, yeah, don't think we need it. If we didn't have the university, I would say, yeah, okay, but we've got the university. I don't think where she comes from her past really needs to be there. She's sort of fully fledged as it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, as a long-running listener to the podcast will know, in recent years I've kind of walked back the idea of watching Doctor Who with my small child. Now, in the intervening years, he's grown a bit. You know, Bruce is nearly six now. Last time Doctor Who was on, he was four.
Good Lord.
And I'm afraid I will not be enjoying the pilot with Bruce in the next, in the coming weeks anyway, not until he's a bit older. There were some scares in there. Now, we had been concerned and we had been told that there was a possibility the Doctor Who was going to be on at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
It was a 7:20 screening here in the UK. The eyeball in the plug hole, that was kind of the killer moment of, oh my God, my son cannot watch this.
Interesting. You think that would be the thing that would freak him?
Yes, definitely, yeah. Do you think there was anything else that was...
I don't know. I mean, as an adult, my thought was the perpetual following.
Right, okay.
Capped, that, you know, you've got someone on your tail that you can't get rid of wherever you go. I mean, it was always the thing with the Daleks. I remember as a kid, one of the things which I found scary in Resurrection of the Daleks, or slightly unnerving, was the fact that they could... Well, they could do this before, but it was highlighted in Resurrection that they could appear on any level of a building. The stairs were not an issue because they could just teleport through a time corridor or go via a time corridor to wherever you were and shoot you.
Or horror unseen.
It kind of made you feel that there was no escaping. There was nowhere that was safe. And while I think there was a very intentional line there where he says, this is your safe place, the TARDIS, nothing can get in here. Was possibly to sort of try and balance out this, although she turns out not to be a massive threat, the threatening feeling of being constantly followed through not just local space, but any space at any time. I kind of thought that might be a bit scary for a kid, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe, as you say, it's the more sort of definitive, momentary things like that which would creep kids out. I don't know. But yeah, I didn't feel in any way, as much as I enjoyed it myself, I didn't feel it was any way geared towards kids in whatsoever. There was nothing there I felt kids would be able to relate to. The university, the students sort of pitched it towards teens upwards.
Yeah.
The characterizations.
Like Class.
Yeah, a little more mature than Class. But yes, I agree with you. Yeah, as if it was looking at sort of upper teens, university, life.
But Bristol University, so not upper teens.
Well, yeah, I didn't mean upper teens. Well, I mean, it was very odd because, I mean, I've never been to Bristol University, but there's this interesting mix between it's having the front of Bristol University. The puddle, was that actually meant to be on the grounds? There's a couple of lines which...
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And then you have this extremely old-fashioned sort of Oxford type sort of tenure room of the doctor.
Yeah.
It was quite weird, but again, I've never been to Bristol, so maybe it does have that element to it. But it didn't feel at all geared in any way towards anything that children would connect to, bar the concept of the Doctor and the TARDIS. So I would be a little concerned about that. The press, it seems to have had very good press. I mean, you mentioned there was a pre-release pre-screening of the Telegraph, wasn't it, you said, which didn't write it up very favorably.
Yeah.
But by and large, it seems to have, from what I've read and what I've seen, it seems to have ticked a lot of boxes.
I would agree, yeah. I think, I don't know what the problem was with the Telegraph. They've had a bit of a problem with Doctor Who over the years because they spent a long time using a guy whose name escapes me. I do apologise if you're listening. The guy who'd won Mastermind with Doctor Who as a specialist subject as the reviewer for many years while I was doing Castor Opus.
Okay.
And they were often mixed reviews. And then more recently they've moved on from this guy and just had a general television reviewer. But that one was very strange. I wonder if they were a bit miffed that they were blocked from reporting something that then came out with regards to the trailer. So, because presumably the John Sim news came from the screenings. And all these papers were, you know, biting, gnawing at the bit to share it, to break the news, break the spoiler, and the BBC got there first. I don't know. But it was interesting to see John Sim at the end of the trailer, actually, I thought.
I was interested by the beard.
Yes.
I kind of felt, again, is this another motif of Stephen, that he does like the canonicity and he knows the fans like canonicity, is the beard.
Well, if you look at the pictures from The End of Time, he has got a bit of stubble going on in The End of Time.
It's a bit of stubble, isn't it? But it's not really, it's not the motif of a goatee.
No.
The goatee is the motif, isn't it? So there's nothing wrong in that. I don't mind. I just think it's interesting when you sort of look to see behavioural characteristics of different creators and what interests them and what doesn't. And I've had a few debates, especially today, just in the last few hours, over the question of the problems of Stephen Moffat, as we've said on this podcast many times, and how convoluted and historically focused it has become, and whether that's a problem for audiences. And one suggestion was End of Time was very convoluted in the same way, and dealing with loss with the show's legacy. I would still argue it wasn't.
Well, the only legacy it was really dealing with was the past 4 years, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the Gallifrey, you didn't need to know anything about Gallifrey prior to Doctor Who, apart from it being the Doctor's home.
Yeah, the Time Lords come in, Rassilon and his Time Lords, they come in like the War Games Time Lords, don't they?
Absolutely, there's nothing like the Time Lords of yore, really. Even them, it's nothing like, it's a different sort of power.
Well, the way they come into it is what I meant.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're introduced as all-powerful and scary.
Yeah, they're related to the Time Wars. Their mannerisms and personality, their matrix, is built on the new series. The Time Wars is an aggressive war that has made warlike Time Lords. So there's nothing in there which really, I mean, the only thing I would concede is the whole thing of the White Point Star and, you know, going through the Master's timeline is perhaps a bit muddy, but it's glossed over very quickly. It's not really a plot point. It's not anything that it expects the audience to really have to mull over. It just needs to know that this is going to be a key that will open a portal and let the Time Lords back. So I don't think, but that is very much Russell T. Davis and how he writes, and yeah, I resonate with that for Doctor Who, because to me Doctor Who is meant for families, and that sort of writing to me speaks to wide audiences. Stephen Moffat's stuff would be great for Big Finish, or, you know, the novels, which are focused on fans who want to sort of explore all those layers of the show and its complexities and its potential complexities as a time travel show. That seems perfect for fans, but it concerns me when it's the main show, which is there for a wide audience, and that's its remit, and you see its audience narrowing.
Mm.
And so there's still debate over whether that's going to be an issue, and I have a horrible feeling that this is going to be the only episode which really feels like a fresh air. And then as the series goes along, it's going to start becoming more convoluted again. I could be wrong. I mean, they certainly got me wrong with the Mavellans and the sonic screwdriver and all that sort of stuff in this episode were very casual and non-focused on the plot, which was great. It was fun, wasn't it? Seeing the Mavellans there again, that was an enjoyable moment, but we didn't need them.
But most people wouldn't have known why they were there. You could say, well, why bother then in the first place? I think it just adds a bit of... I think that's the sort of... looking, you know, backwards looking continuity, you know, like the fanish stuff that you can get away with because it's just there and you can take it or leave it. It's when you start going down the Attack of the Cybermen route
when
it starts getting overly heavy for... But, you know, I say all this. And then last weekend, Ant and Dec's Saturday Night Takeaway, which was running a weekly serial thing, where they have some sort of crown jewels theft adventure story for 10 minutes of each episode, whatever. Not entirely sure what was happening. But the final episode of it relied on the audience knowing that Ant and Dec had a hit single 20 years previously. So, maybe there isn't that much to worry about with these things. I don't know. Maybe the internet changed everything.
If the viewing figures weren't hitting under 4 million for a primetime show, I'd probably say I wouldn't be that worried, but I...
Well, we're under 5 million.
Well, what for beginning of season 9?
Right. Well, last night.
I'm not consolidating with iPlayer because iPlayer.
No. That's fine. No. So the overnights, 4.6 million for last night's episode. Series 9, The Magician's Apprentice overnight was 4.58 million.
Oh, good lord. Not a massive change.
It's not a massive change. I'm hoping that.
There's positivity, word of mouth.
People pick up a bit more on the delayed viewing.
That would be nice. And again, going next next week as well. Sometimes it is always about the judgment of the week prior can only be made from the whether people tune in the following week. So yeah, absolutely. But I don't think there's any problem with occasionally nodding back. I mean, you could sort of say Davros in Journey's End. I mean, he wasn't, again, his history with the Doctor wasn't particularly focused on. There was never any sort of commentary on why he had a hand again or why where he had been. And I'm not saying that Moffat always does that. He didn't do that with Missy. He didn't even do that with Davros, to be fair to him.
Mm.
So, but I think sometimes it's fine to sort of take from the past because people will have memories and some of your audiences will remember those sort of things. As long as it remains accessible for the new people. And yeah, I mean, the Anton Deck thing might have made a few newer people more confused. You're quite right. But I think it's when it's a consistent issue. And it seems doesn't seem many places you don't see where they talk about the convoluted writing and the timey-wimey. And this stuff is quite clever. I mean, I think it's important that people have to acknowledge that we're not saying that he is a terrible writer. Well, Brian might be if he was here. I mean, his time stuff is very clever. Other times it is very clever. But it's not necessarily the right thing, maybe, all the time. Mm. I don't know. I mean, I think, even though I never liked season 5 particularly, his season 5 was very different to what he does now, say his season 9.
Yeah, and there was a bit of time wearing stuff going on with series 5 as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was.
With the shirt and
everything. With the shirt, yeah, absolutely, and even down to the Sonic screwdrivers, you know, that sort of stuff was there. And I don't think there's a problem with that. I think audiences are fine with it. And this was a sort of debate I was trying to put forward, is that the audiences will look at Back to the Future, and they'll look at, say, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and they'll, or general audiences will enjoy it for the characters. They may be vaguely amused when they get to a bit where there's something a bit sort of head screwy, that, you know, there's two DeLoreans or, you know, two sets of keys thanks to timey-wiminess, and they'll enjoy that because it just punctuates and it gives them something to think about. But if it's constantly doing that the whole time, then I don't think audiences get engaged with that because that's not what they've come to look for, if that sort of makes sense. It's sort of like, you know, you go and have a... If you have a cake, you might enjoy the bit of icing on the top, but it doesn't mean you want icing throughout the cake. It becomes too sweet, so you don't eat the cake. But it doesn't mean that you have an issue with icing. It just means that you have a certain amount of the quantities, and I think it's the quantities which are probably fluctuating, the quantities of... historical, you know, television show history of time convolutions, of retrospective issues like River Song and all this sort of stuff. It's just too much. And I think it's just slowly bags the show down, as it did in the 80s. Because many fans seem to agree, but they don't always agree now, which is odd because, you know, that it is a problem for wide audiences. It's going to be.
Yeah. With regards to The Master...
Yeah,
and we're going to be talking about The Master Loads this
absolutely.
Series,
I am looking
without a doubt. In the end of time, the Master was dead. He died at the end of his previous appearance in The Sound of Drums.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes, yes.
And then he's alive again.
Yeah,
through some so presumably when he died, he lost the ability to regenerate because he refused to regenerate. His body's burnt, and then he's brought back. So he's brought back through whatever bizarre magical stuff it was his ability to regenerate brought back with him at the same time? You would kind of think, well, probably not. Which begs the question, where does Missy come into it? Because the Time Lords aren't going to voluntarily let the Master back, are they? Surely.
It's an interesting thing. It depends what that ring was, doesn't it? That brings him back in End of Time.
Mm.
I mean, was it Time Lord technology? Was it stolen? Because they were resurrecting Time Lords, which is how he appears in Utopia, was the whole idea. Well, Rassilon certainly was. I assume the Master was resurrected as well.
The dialogue says in those final episodes in Series 3 that he was resurrected to fight in the Time War. So.
Yes, so maybe if that's the case, that could be stolen resurrection technology. And if it resurrects and it changes Jacoby to Sim, there's no argument that if that ring resurrects again, which is the best answer for it, I think, because it is a bit of a... And I said this in this argument I was having over debate, should I say, over the end of time, is that even that thing in the story, which is a bit convoluted because it requires you to remember that he had a wife, who when he was in Utopia 2 years before, not Utopia, Sound of Drums. It is just really ritual, isn't it? It's the mystic ritual that brings him back. There's virtually no technology suggested at all.
It is a
bit of blood and, monks almost, and he reappears. But ultimately, I think you've got to assume that's so high tech. I would like to think that that's sort of resurrection technology akin to what the Time Lords were using. So that could have recreated him. Or equally, it could perhaps recreate another one and you could have the Missy. I'm still hoping, and not out of any revisionism, that they allow the Master, Sim's Master, to exist as himself and allow Missy to be Missy somehow. Even if it's like the Master split into two and she is a sort of almost like a Valyard of the Master. I hope we wouldn't go down that route of using those terms, but a distillation of some sort. That would be really good because that would mean she could still be the Master, but she could be her own thing. And, Sim and his successor, I don't even care if it's her successor or becomes a her, that would be great. I just kind of think that Missy just doesn't really stretch me as the Master because there's just her interest in the Doctor. Yeah, she's got the interest in the Doctor. It doesn't feel like the Master's interest in the Doctor. And I don't know whether that's because he's over-gendered it. But she just feels like she should be her own personality, her own character, and allow, the Master to be the Master. So I don't feel that friendship with her and him. I know she talks about it, but it's never really there in the action.
No.
It just feels like the Joker. It's that sort of character. It's the sort of fast, witty and anarchist, which makes her quite exciting to watch, but it doesn't make her the Master. The Master wasn't an anarchist in my mind. Okay, yeah, he would end up having plans which are ridiculously anarchistic maybe, but not to really create anarchy.
He's more interested in overthrowing for his own gain. Yeah.
I mean, Lugopolis, he threatens anarchy essentially, or just destruction essentially, to get his own way, and it's a ridiculous plot point, but he wants order. He wants order because he wants control, and to have control, you've got to have structure.
His own order, yeah.
Yeah, he just wants it in his own. He's a very sort of old-fashioned Machiavellian villain in that sort of sense. Well, she isn't. She's something very new wave, very sort of Joker, anarchy sort of thing. And she needs her own role there for that. So yeah, I'm kind of hoping that he will split her off. I have a feeling he won't, because he does like his creations. And he does love his creations having long continuity legacies. So I don't think he will. But if she was a distillation, that would be really exciting. I'd be interested to know how... I wonder what he's thinking about this, the interest in Sim coming back. Is he thrilled about that, or does he just take it on board, or does he feel a bit threatened by it? Because, the Missy is his Master. John Sim is Davis's. And there's no doubt, as creators, you're going to have a certain amount of defensiveness and reflection on your colleagues, on what their work and your work and how it compares and how it relates. And he's essentially bringing in, a character from another character from Davis's era, which is something he's very rarely done.
Yes, I wonder if we'll see Captain Jack as well.
It would be interesting. I'd be very surprised.
But there was kind of rumours, wasn't there? There was old Barrowman going on about something. Yes. I can't remember. He might have broken into song halfway through. I forget. But
I could see Barrowman returning in Chibnall's. I could see Chibnall using him, obviously for Torchwood being the strong connection as well.
Yeah.
But he would probably fit. If they go with Chibnall the way I think, or the way we think they're going to go, Captain Jack would probably fit that. If they're sort of going to a more sort of broader sort of Davis approach, to get audiences, then Jack will fit that. So I could see Jack coming back. I think Moffat's going to focus. Well, no, I'm wrong, because I was going to say he's going to focus on a sort of winding up his own era with his own characters, but John Sim is against that. So maybe I'm totally wrong.
Maybe you are. Well, there's another way that you might be wrong about that, yeah? Which we need to come to in a bit. I just want to jump back into the comments that we've had. We've had Samuel Grieve considers Bill far more likable than expected. I had that as well. The scene was cut down, wasn't it, considerably?
I was just going to say that, yeah.
The Dalek
scene. That was
scene.
A thrill to see that totally obliterated.
Yeah.
Because that was terrible, and it was really nice. That was good. Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad he noticed that. Other people noticed that.
Alex Tai, who was at one point a Casterbris contributor, felt it was good fodder for a series opener. Charm of opening like a reboot. Capaldi was his usual brilliantly charming, charmless, unhuman, human self with flashes of past incarnations. Shame it's his last season, as I feel this Doctor has a lot more to give.
Yeah, I feel the same, I think, after seeing that.
After that,
Last series, I was quite happy to see him go. I thought they'd screwed him up. But this series,
Based on one episode.
Based on one episode, yeah. I know. But it's nice to have that energy back, to feel enthusiasm and to like stuff. I mean, because, say, we've always been very conscious that we've constantly had a go at a lot of the stuff under this tenure, this production tenure. Mm. But it's really nice to be able to sort of say good things about it. And it's not about sort of trying to say he's doing it the way I think it should be done. I think he's doing things which just work for the show. It feels confident. It feels more confident than I've ever seen him. I've seen him write in a long time.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I don't want to draw comparisons. But, you know, the last thing I watched by Stephen Moffat was an episode of Sherlock earlier this year.
Yes.
This felt just far more entertaining than it. I'm not sure which one's Moffat wrote. I presume it was the last one, but I don't know. This was just entertaining and fun, which Doctor Who hasn't been for a long time.
It felt balanced. I mean, you were saying that you were wondering how they'd fit things in. Mm. I must admit, I was in category one. I wasn't even really that looking at the clock. I was just enjoying the pace and the ideas, and I think it was just so unusual to have nothing in there to be irritating me. And for years, there's always been something, be it with a song. I must admit, seeing her picture on his desk irritated me. And put next to Susan's, because that, again, seems a very strong statement that River Song is as important to the legacy of Doctor Who now than as Susan. And you think feels really irritating to see one person put their own legacy on the, you know, to the same pedestal, which he has essentially, as the original companion. I must admit, I wouldn't put it against the show, but yeah, it did irritate me.
There's been some rumours, speculation, let's call it, that Susan is making an appearance in physical form.
Yeah, I even saw a speculation that Bill is Susan in some form, which I don't think he'll go down there.
No.
I hadn't noticed the Bill and Heather.
Well, I saw an interesting tweet. Someone stated on Twitter, which did seem to be without any irony whatsoever, that William Hartnell would be absolutely thrilled to be... To have been paid tribute with a lesbian couple in Doctor Who. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that, but given what we know about William Hartnell, I'm doubtful.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah, I agree. But, I kind of hope that was just thought of afterwards. I'd hate to think that she was just named purely as, another bit of fan dressing.
Who knows? Well, listen, anyway, talk about fan dressing. There's lots of dressing going on in the vault beneath the university. I say a lot of dressing, not much dressing, just a metal door and then some lights and stuff. And we don't know what's in there. There's speculation about what's in there. One of the things that has been speculated that's in there, my voice is going, so I'm going to let you talk in a moment, is that the next Doctor's in there.
Right.
Whether or not that's the case, we don't know. But what we do know is that two tabloid newspapers have declared that Chris Marshall is the next Doctor.
Yes. And still nothing from BBC on
the
scene.
Still nothing from the BBC, yeah.
Probably aside from a most likely seething anger, if it is.
I mean, you're going to have to monologue for a moment. I mean, this is something we've talked about a lot. And we've speculated a lot over the past few months, whether this might be the case or not. We've been given Aidan Turner as a possible name for a replacement Doctor. Only a couple of weeks ago, one of the papers was reporting to BBC Insider was saying that they were looking for a 30-something Doctor. With I think the word dashing was in there as well. Chris Marshall's in his 40s. How are you feeling about this? Do you think it is Chris Marshall?
I think it's Chris Marshall. I mean, he was running 2-1 odds, which were pretty high. I think he is what they'd be looking for. I don't think he's a mind-blowing choice. And I think he is a very safe choice for a quirky Doctor who has a certain amount of profile. He has a little bit of profile. Was it Love Actually he was in? Or I can't remember which one of those he was in. He was in one of the big sort of internationals, I'm sure, which gives him a little bit of that usual Doctor profile that you get of someone who's not too big but has a certain amount of recognition.
He was in Love Actually.
Love Actually. So he was in Love Actually. So I wondered whether, you know, I think for that reason, I think he's got a youthful countenance, but he's got the experience and he's got age behind him, which... he's 44 years old, so he's by no means young, but he has that mixture, and maybe perhaps the timelessness is what they're looking for, because I mean he does have a youthful demeanor even if he's no longer a young lad, and that's possibly something that they need, someone who can sort of have a bit of youthful vibrancy to it yet at the same time carry the sort of the acting experience to play off such a role. But he is a very safe one, and as people have said, well, you know, this could have been a good opportunity to have had a black Doctor or an Asian Doctor, or even, as some obviously said, a woman. But it always felt at this moment where the ratings have not been at a level which the BBC is happy with, that they were going to do anything that was going to be dangerous, that anything that was going to actually counter a broader audience. They're after a broad audience at the moment, and Chris Marshall feels, especially with his background of Death in Paradise and My Family, someone who would speak to a broad British audience. And I think that's something people have got to remember, that the show was commissioned, or as far as I'm aware anyway, it's still commissioned through BBC One, and as such its primary mandate is to BBC One as part of its programming schedule. How well it does abroad, how well it does for BBC Worldwide, how well it does for BBC, you know, those are all important factors, but primarily it is still a show for BBC One. And BBC One, Chris Marshall has a certain amount of identity to the people who watch sort of BBC One. So I think there's a lot of reasons to assume it probably is right. Plus it's timing. This is a point where they're going to be getting ready for filming. This is, I would think that this has been signed up ages ago, especially since he left Death in Paradise a few months back. So I think this would feel quite logical that it's him, that this agreement's gone through, and
mid-season
it's only now
as well.
Back end of the season, I think he missed one episode in total, but yeah, absolutely.
I think it was two.
He appears in the, unless he doesn't appear, I've watched the end of the season and Ardal has one by himself, and then he shares the penultimate one with Chris. So either way, yes, you're right. It was certainly not done after production had finished. It was done while the show was still in production. He's not there for some of the final block. So that, again, is an interesting choice to suddenly bow out so quickly, which they sort of suggested at the time, like with Ben Miller, was the fact that he just wanted to be back home. But this all has strands of making sense. And again, yeah, it could be totally wrong. And the BBC could be laughing at this moment. I have a horrible feeling, and I'm sure the BBC is having as well, these feelings of deja vu, that this is another situation where they've been beaten to the punch in the announcement. And especially if they ever plan to do a Next Doctor piece like they did a few years ago with Capaldi, then they'd be frustrated. Though they've been leaving it very late if that was the case. So I'm assuming they were just going to run an announcement.
Probably, I mean, yeah.
Capaldi was announced, what was it, January, February, late January?
No, it was August. Was it his departure?
No, his arrival. I'm just thinking.
His casting. It was summer. It was August because we did that live podcast, didn't we? Yeah, it was in the summer. Yeah.
So it was in the summer. Okay. So yeah, maybe.
It was the summer prior to the Day of the Doctor. So most people were looking forward to. They knew there was a new Doctor coming, and we're looking forward to the 50th anniversary story. And then they dropped this big television special.
But that's it. But I'm just interested. Because there was a suggestion this year that they were going to do another Next Doctor special.
Oh, God.
But the interesting thing is, if you're going on that timeline, this is very early to have had the announcement.
Mm. Well, they could be the Next Doctor special they could be doing could actually be an episode of Doctor Who, because there's also been speculation that the Doctor's going to regenerate early.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder whether he won't do that. I wonder whether somehow he's going to intermix them and even sort of kick it off with the two Doctors almost, and more so than he did with Time and the Doctor, either have him regenerating backwards and forth or something different and unusual. Because I have a feeling Moffat's going to want to go out with something, and it would explain the copious regeneration shot so far and why they might be announcing now or not announcing now, why the papers might be able to announce now, because I'm just reading some of the I thought I'd read something saying it was false. No, sorry, ignore that. It would be interesting if it is announced now, if they're already, if because it was announced because the Mirror source says that they've started filming, wasn't it? Or about to start filming.
Although he'd already shot, yeah.
Or he'd already shot. So this is very early to be shooting for next series.
Next series, yeah, because it hasn't started yet. Actual production has not started yet. It doesn't happen until Broadchurch is out the way.
So if he's actually shooting stuff for this series or the Christmas special, which would suggest an early one. So if that's the case, then him being found out now would make sense if he is appearing early. If he's not appearing till next series, then maybe this story isn't accurate. But the very end of the Christmas special. It depends when they're filming the Christmas special, to be honest.
I think they're filming it at the moment.
So he could be on set for that. It could be the final scenes of that, for all we know.
Could be, for all we know, as you say. Just going back to Death in Paradise. Death in Paradise does good business for BBC Worldwide.
Uh-huh.
Overseas. And, of course, as we mentioned previously when we talked about Chris Marshall, is that his time on Death in Paradise has increased the profile of the show, which started with two series of Ben Miller as the lead. And it's got higher viewing figures with Chris Marshall in charge. So he is, as you say, a big face for the BBC.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he'd be good. I think he'll be good. It'll depend on how he's written. Hmm. And I think Capaldi is the ultimate example of this. That how Capaldi's been written, he's been written different for three series now, for me. So it shows how much the actor can only bring a certain amount, and then it's just down to what they're given and how they're directed. So depending on what they do with him, and I'm hoping that they will do as they've sort of done with Capaldi and made him a little more relaxed and chilled out. I don't know. I mean, he's quite an energetic character, Chris Marshall. I would see him as almost like a Davison character, someone who isn't there firing off these constant sort of Smith/Tom Baker witticisms, but has a sort of energy to them, a sort of friendly energy that I think would work really well for him. But will they do that, or will they just go down the route of making him mad and quirky?
Only time will tell.
But yeah, I'm okay with it. I mean, you're okay with it. I mean, it's,
yeah, I'm okay with it. I've always found him a watchable and charming actor, even doing stuff that I don't like, he's good.
Yeah, absolutely. I loathe My Family, but he was good in that.
He was great in it. Yeah, he was. I think we can possibly blame him for his long term success, to be honest with you, because he made it watchable when it started.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's a good casting choice, and also given that there's concerns over the show's popularity. Within Britain, it's BBC popularity, that I think he's got a good chance of sort of bringing back some viewing figures to it. If we're wrong, I mean, we could be wrong. Maybe this is the sort of nominal viewing figures you'll get now for a show like Doctor Who. I don't know. I hope not. And I think it'd be very sad if he does get the viewing figures, because I think Capaldi deserves them. But the show has made massive mistakes. It's become too niche in my eyes. And as a niche person who knows all the niche stuff, that to me has always been my worry.
Yeah, and you definitely know your niches.
Well, absolutely. I do love my niche.
I dare not refer to any Japanese animation without being corrected by Mr. McLean.
Yeah, but I mean, we're all niche in Doctor Who. And it's one of those sort of things where it's in a funny situation where you're there arguing against the show because it's too niche. But you're doing that because you know it's too niche for what it's meant to be doing. And the viewing figures sort of kind of show that. But as, I think also, one of the final points on it, like you said, and I think it's very true, is if you look at Sherlock this year and you look at this, this felt like a very confidently written and produced show, while Sherlock felt nervously worried about how to. And that largely, I think, is because it's become so big. As soon as it becomes big, it becomes harder to write. I wonder what for Stephen here, maybe knowing this is his last series has made it in some ways easier for him to write. The pressures have become less, and he's relaxed, and he's just writing without feeling that he needs to be clever and witty all the time. And there is wit in there, and it's and he's writing this really well. He wrote this really nice little character piece, and I like the staging. You said, you know, about the vault and everything. I think that's a nice staging for the series, and we've talked about that before, about the staging changing to perhaps give it a bit of vitality. Mm-hmm. And if it's now sort of slightly sort of based at the university with them going off here, there and everywhere, I don't know. I think that's kind of interesting.
It certainly brings us into a new era of Doctor Who, if only for 12 episodes. Thanks to all of you for your comments, and those of you who didn't comment, thank you for any comment that you might make in future, or any thoughts that you've had about this podcast, whether you've shared them with us or not. We'll be back next week. Until next time, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.